Today, from hardware to software to netware, the basis of American power in the 21st century. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering finance and product news and other things with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today I'm joined again by Salvador Baranes from the University of Sydney. Hello, Salvador.
Hi, good to talk to you.
And you've been very busy crafting more stuff, and you touched on this at the end of our last interview. I needed to follow up because this sounded like a really interesting conversation.
Well, thanks. This is actually what my academic research is about. So this is what I do for a living as opposed to a hobby.
Okay. Well, it could be quite serious then. But you know, the transition from a hardware world to a software world to a netware world is fundamentally what you're on about.
Well, when we think of American power, just to go back a little bit to the intro, we think about American power, people use indicators of what's called hegemony or control in the world, using things like percentage of global GDP in one country. And of course, by that measure, the U.S. reached its peak in 1945 and has been declining ever since. And we use all sorts of indicators that have this kind of historical legacy to them. So before people used GDP, they used indicators like percentage of global steel production to measure centrality in the world economy. And of course, by that measure, you know, South Korea was the global hegemon in the 1990s and early 2000s, overtaken by China. These measures are really out of date. Whether we use measures like shipping or steel or even GDP, those are really 19th and 20th century measures. What matters today is the world of technology. And in the world of technology, the United States is absolutely dominant. Now, let me take you on a journey through technology of the last 40 years or 50 years in the era of globalization. You go back to the 1970s, the key part of technology was the hardware, and the United States was the leader in computer hardware. By the 1980s, software started to become more important. We saw the rise of Microsoft and that famous battle between IBM and Microsoft over who would control the desktop. You know, Microsoft was just a bit contractor for IBM in 1982. Then, of course, throughout the course of the 1980s and 1990s, it became Microsoft the giant, and IBM's hardware became commoditized, so much so that IBM even sold it off and reinvented itself as a computer services company. But in the 2000s, we've seen a shift towards what I like to call netware. That is, apps that connect people or things or information online, connecting them to each other, where the real value is not in the hardware that you hold in your hand. The real value is not in the software that runs on the machine. The real value is in the network.
Right. And that, of course, enables a whole bunch of things to be done differently. And it enables quite a different approach to where power lies.
Well, in networks, power lies at the center. You know, the spider in the center of the web is the one who's controlling everything. And in networks, the United States has become absolutely central in global networks in the globalization era. Just think, I challenge your listeners to think of a single online netware company that is a company that uses networks as a way of generating value. Think of one global netware company that isn't American. And you go down the list, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Uber, we can come up with dozen
Airbnb.
More.
I mean, there are a few there are a few in China.
Ah, but are they global? So if you're in China, chances are you use WeChat for messaging. WeChat is absolutely dominant within China. Yep. Outside China, mostly members of the Chinese diaspora use WeChat. Everyone else is on WhatsApp. I mean, I recently came back from spending 2019 in Europe. In Europe, WhatsApp is universally used instead of phone calls. People don't call you on the phone. They contact you on WhatsApp. It's replaced instant messaging and phone calls. But WhatsApp, of course, is an American company now owned by Facebook. In fact, going down the list, I've challenged people in my lectures to think of a global netware company that is not American. And the highest placed one I've had anyone give me, a music professor actually pointed out, Spotify is Swedish. So there we go. We've got a Swedish company in the global top 20 or 30 network companies. But even Spotify is rapidly falling down. If we think of, you know, the new video streaming services, you know, which are almost entirely American based. So, you know, Netflix has been around a long time, but Disney Plus, Apple TV, you know, you name it. Now, individual countries do have competitors. Australia has Stan. India has Hotstar. But in every market around the world, it's four or five American giants, one or two local competitors, and that's it. That is, nobody in India is streaming on Stan. Nobody in Australia is streaming on Hotstar. Right? Instead, it's either Netflix, Disney Plus, or your local service. And that's true whether it's social networks. I mean, in Russia and the former Soviet Union, VK is a very popular social network, VKontakte. But outside the former Soviet Union, only members of the Russian diaspora use it. In China, of course, WeChat is dominant. Or even if you think of Alibaba, Alibaba is the world's largest e-commerce site. It's bigger than Amazon in terms of total sales. But outside of China, Alibaba has really struggled to establish a presence. It's only been able to do so by offering extreme discounted deals, because most people choose to be on that American network.
That's really interesting. And I guess there's something else that occurs to me, is that if, you know, the likes of, let's say, Netflix is in a dominant position in terms of content, it also then connotes a set of cultural norms as well, doesn't it?
Well, the question is, why is America so dominant in these spheres? And I don't think it has to do with the American government forcing people in an imperialistic way to adopt American technology. Instead, it's about American individualism. These networks are focused on the United States for two reasons. First, because of that individualistic ethos in America that produces lots of these sorts of new business ideas. And second, because of the size of the U.S. domestic market. So that individuals, global individuals, if you're a global individual with a great idea for a new social network, you don't develop it in New Zealand. ideally, you go to Silicon Valley to develop your business idea, because if you can get it developed in America, it will become a global standard. And that's self-reinforcing. But it's a voluntary sort of imperialism. We choose to be part of this American system. We're not forced into it. I mean, let me give the example of Australia and local content laws. There's a lot of debate right now over the internet in Australia, and should Australia have local content requirements for video streaming services like Netflix? And Australia might. I mean, the European Union has put in place local content laws. But the result of local content laws is that Australia would get a more limited video streaming universe. That is, Australians have a choice: either have no restrictions, get the entire global internet of content, or put in place a local content law, and instead of increasing the numerator, that is, local content expresses Australian content divided by total content of the streaming service, instead of increasing that numerator, streaming services will just decrease the denominator. That is, they will make less and less global content available to Australians if Australians want to regulate it. And that same situation has already been faced in Europe, where Netflix in Europe does not offer, for example, its Hindi language productions, because in Europe they have local content requirements, which means that if Netflix were to offer its entire library, the European percentage would be too small. So as a result, Europe gets second-class Netflix. Europe will get second-class Disney Plus. When Disney Plus rolls out in Europe. And it would be the same for Australia. So globally, everyone faces a choice: either assert independence, but have a second-class internet, or be open and accept American dominance of the internet.
Well, how does that play out then? Because there's a discussion here in Australia at the moment about effectively imposing charges on the big content providers to effectively flow money back to the local content producers.
Right, and this is something that they're also talking about in Europe. And the problem is that it simply won't work. If Google, the local content has virtually no value for Google. If anything, if there were a market in it, the content owners would be paying Google to feature their material. I mean, that's how Google's entire revenue model works. Google doesn't pay people to be on the internet. people pay Google to rank them high in search results. Now, Google, I mean, I don't think we can say that a global internet giant like Google is nice, but in a way, Google has forborne. Google has not abused its power to the maximum extent when it comes to news. And instead of putting pay for news first in the news results, it just lets all news results pop up equally. And it, in fact, favors national news results. So that if you're in Australia, on Google News right now, where no money is exchanged, Google will give you the Australian content first, which, if you ask me, is kind of nice of them. They don't have to do that. Now, if you were to make Google pay for Australian content, they simply won't carry Australian news, or they will cherry pick only the very most important Australian stories. And everything else you'll get on Google News will be Reuters, Deutsche Welle, BBC, American content, which is available for free. You can't force the internet, you can't force networks to behave the way you want them to. You can limit your exposure to networks, that's what China has done, but you can't push onto networks because the network is just too big for any country to manage.
Right, so they will continue to maintain their dominance. And I guess they've also accumulated constellations of capabilities by acquiring other businesses and just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So it's like the Rolling Stone, right? It just collects more and more snow as it goes down the hill and gets bigger.
Well, that's what we call the network externalities. That is, for Google or Facebook or any network, for Netflix, I mean, even for Uber, I mean, for any company that makes its money by connecting things online, they can monetize additional nodes in the network. So for Uber, every additional driver, every additional customer, that improves the operation of their network and makes it more profitable. So they are able to benefit from it. But for me personally, there's no benefit to my data. That is, me being on a social network all myself, I could start salvatorebonus.net and have my own network, but if I'm the only one on it, it's useless to me. Yeah. On the other hand, it is useful to Uber if I join them. And that's why a lot of the narrative about who owns your data really misses the point. I mean, if you try to make companies pay for your data, they just won't use your data. You just won't be part of the network. And you're the one who suffers. Now, that's not fair. That may not even be good, but that's the reality of the situation. We have a choice to either be part of the internet or to exclude ourselves. And anyone who wants to turn the internet off can just pull that cable and not be online, you know, close off that Wi-Fi connection. We choose to be part of it because we benefit from it, even if we're giving away our data free, we are allowing US companies to suck the blood out of local economies. This is all true. I'm not saying the criticisms are false. I'm saying that the structure of power on the internet means that it's inevitable that American companies will be central to it, even though the United States government as such does very little to make that necessary.
Mm. So I was going to ask the obvious question, you know, these large internet corporations, to what extent are they connected to American government and American power, directly or indirectly? I mean, you know, is there a strong connection or is it actually really just happenstance?
There's surprisingly little connection. And that little connection is one of the reasons why it works. Mm. It works because the U.S. does not attempt to stifle and control these networks. I mean, there are some rules about accessing data in cases of criminality, but even that, there's been pushback, right? I mean, when Apple had data of a crime being committed, a murder on their phones, they refused to unlock it at first. Then it took a court battle and everything. Now, that's very different from the situation, say, in Russia or China, where social networks cooperate very closely with government. But as a result, those Russian and Chinese networks end up being much less attractive to people. And so the net gain for the United States is in maintaining an open internet, which, even though it limits American power, it makes America more powerful overall. And that's the bizarre conundrum of libertarianism in general, that a government with limited powers, like the United States government, is actually more powerful than governments that have extensive powers. Mm. Because we all participate in American networks while we're cautious about participating in Chinese networks. I mean, no company in Australia, no non-Chinese company in Australia keeps its data on Alibaba's cloud services. Alibaba is trying to compete with Amazon, but we know that Alibaba is beholden to the Chinese government. On the other hand, Australia's own government has contracted with Amazon to provide cloud services for its COVID-safe app. Mm. Well, that's because they trust Amazon. Yes, there's some minor concerns that the U.S. government could, with a court order, access data, but that's nothing like the concerns that would be raised if it were using a Chinese cloud services company.
So I guess the obvious question then is, play this forward for me, right? So are we going to see, you know, a proliferation of other companies coming in, or are those main companies that are there today going to get bigger and bigger and effectively extend their power further? How do you think it's going to play out?
Well, first, let's forget about China for a minute. Everyone likes to view China as a rising competitor on the basis of its big GDP, big industrial production, its new aircraft carriers. But in this new networks world, China can only compete inside China. And I think that's become very clear. People just don't trust Chinese networks. Think, though, about the European Union. European Union economy is larger than that of the United States. There are more people in the European Union than the United States. Why aren't European companies challenging American companies in the internet? And ultimately, why isn't the European Union a peer competitor for the United States for global power? And I think the answer to that really comes down to the American individualistic approach to the world. American individualism has led to incredible success in the internet, which is a world of everyone does her or his individual thing, and whatever works sticks. You know, no one forced us to use Zoom meetings. We're using a Zoom meeting right now. There are a dozen meeting software providers. But we have chosen the one that just kind of works, and everyone has gravitated towards that. Now, Facebook has its own meeting software. Google has its own meeting software. You'd think, oh, they're so powerful, they'll control everything. Well, Zoom has come out of nowhere to beat Facebook and Google. The point, though, is that they're all based in the United States. I mean, Zoom was actually founded by a Chinese immigrant to the United States who preferred the freedom of California to the stifling environment of China. What we see in the American-dominated internet is that the freedom and individualism of the United States sucks in people, companies, and ideas from China, from Europe, from all over the world, and then sends them back out to the world, but in a network that is U.S.-centered. So even though the European Union is larger and richer than the United States, or at least larger and has higher GDP than the United States, it's a non-competitor when it comes to the 21st century online economy.
And is that because English is effectively now a foundational capability?
I don't think it's just English, because English is widely spoken in the European Union. It's the spirit, it's the approach. The European approach to technology is to centralize it and regulate it. It's a very, you know, intellectually French approach to rationality. No, and I don't mean that just as a joke. I mean, think to the famous European Enlightenment and the 18th century philosophers and the idea of an encyclopedia that would encapsulate all knowledge. The French approach to creating a universal encyclopedia was to find the top experts, have each of them summarize everything that is known in one big centralized project through a French academy. Now contrast that with the American approach to a universal encyclopedia, Wikipedia. Well, just put up a website. Anyone who knows anything can contribute to that website. Okay. So the American approach has produced an incredibly large encyclopedia, impossibly large if you were to compare it with a European-style, top-down, assigned articles approach. Yet it's done it with no central coordination or very little central coordination, just by opening it up and letting people contribute. And that's really the difference between the American approach and the European approach. It's one of, you know, freedom versus regulation. And I really can't stress that too much. I mean, of course, the United States has regulation. Of course, Europeans are free. But the basic approach, the basic mindset throughout all of European Union decision making is, how can we rationally approach this? The American approach instead is completely irrational. It's very actually closely tied to Darwinian ideas of evolution. It's let every possible idea try. And whichever one happens to work, that's the one we'll go forward with.
And my last question is there subliminal influence coming through this? And are there a set of implicit values that a lot of these organizations have? And does that mean that those values then flow out around to the rest of the world? And so you almost get an Americanization of thinking into other geographies?
It is a complete Americanization of thinking. And I really want to emphasize that individualism is a uniquely American approach to how we organize our lives. It's not a Western or European approach. So the Western approach is rationalism. It's rational design. It's creative. You know, think of the German engineer who builds the perfect car. That's the European approach. The do whatever you want is very California. It's not very Stuttgart. And that approach has really, you know, it came from America's English heritage. There's strong connections to English individualism. Australia has inherited a good deal of that, the, you know, the frontier mentality. But when it comes down to it, it's been exported to the rest of the world by the United States. Originally, you know, through movies and film and music, but even more so through the online world. I mean, I visited a few years ago, I visited Belarus. Belarus is a authoritarian country still ruled by the person who took over during the collapse of the Soviet Union. It has no diplomatic relations with the United States. There's no U.S. embassy in Minsk in Belarus. Yet, even in Belarus, I met dozens of people who were working in the gig economy. That is, you know, gig websites existed. They wanted money. They prefer dollars to Belarusian rubles. So as individuals, they choose to integrate into that American-centered internet. No one's making them. In fact, their own government originally tried to discourage them. But they want to be individuals. They want to be part of what they think of as the global future. And that change from, you know, we exist to serve our families and our countries and our communities, to we exist to pursue our own destiny. Well, that's good or bad. I mean, I'm not advocating it. I'm saying that it has become inevitable. The Marquis de Lafayette, who was an assistant to George Washington in the U.S. Revolution, he said that once there was one place in the world that was free, authority would no longer have any home because people could always leave their authoritarian environment and go to the United States. And that is very much true today, not just physically, but virtually. We can all choose to live in that free world online, even if we live under repressive regimes in places like Belarus, Russia, and China. People have become global individuals no matter where they live.
It's the power of the network, isn't it?
It is the power of the network, and the United States is the center of those networks. It doesn't control the networks, and that's the crucial point. If it controlled the networks would not flourish in the way that they do. But having that almost hands-off approach, that very light-touch approach to networks, has led to networks centralizing in the United States and carrying American values and approaches back out to the rest of the world.
Well, Salvatore, I really appreciate your time today. That's a really insightful commentary on what's going on, and it certainly makes a lot of sense to me. So thanks very much for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show.
Okay, talk again soon. Cheers.